Thank you very much, Mark and Consul General, other distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for the invitation to join you today here. Yes, it has been interesting over that 8.5 years, and I continue to pray every evening for boredom, but that has not as yet been given. Well, this is AmCham, so in an audience like this, in what will be some very brief opening remarks before we have questions, I might be expected to attempt some comparisons between the US economy and the Australian economy. So let me offer the following snapshot for your information. In America, growth has improved over the past year, having been much lower than policymakers would have liked for quite a few years, following a very deep recession in 2008. In Australia, the economy is growing, but somewhat more slowly than most of us would like. We haven't had a deep downturn for more than 20 years. In America, real GDP per head is 2.75% higher now than its previous peak in December of 2007. In Australia, real GDP per head is 5.5% higher than it was in December 2007. In America, the unemployment rate peaked at 10% in October of 2009, and it's fallen to be about 5.5% now. In Australia, the unemployment rate in October of 2009 was 5.5%. It then fell, and then it's risen very slowly more recently to be about 6.25% now. In America, the average rate of unemployment for the 21st century, so since 2000, is 6.5%. In Australia, the average rate of unemployment in the 21st century, 5.5%. In America, inflation is low, asset values are increasing, interest rates are extremely low, but the central bank is talking about increasing them. In Australia, inflation is low, asset values have been increasing, interest rates are very low, but the central bank has been talking about lowering them further. In America, international competitiveness is declining due to the rising US dollar. In Australia, international competitiveness is increasing because of the declining Australian dollar. And finally, in America, there is political partisanship across a range of issues and budget stalemate. In Australia, there is political partisanship across a range of issues and, over the past year at least, budget stalemate. The result of all that? American businesses and households seem to be getting more optimistic about the future. But Australian businesses and households seem, if anything, to be getting less optimistic about our future. It would be an interesting conversation over the rest of your lunch to talk about how well those facts lead to those two differing outcomes. Admittedly, the global backdrop in some respects is less supportive to Australia now than it had been some years ago. You all know this story. Our terms of trade are falling. They have been falling for about 3.5 years now. It had always been understood, actually, that this would occur, even if we weren't all that accurate in predicting it. We predicted it way too early, actually. So we didn't predict its timing, we predicted it too soon, and we haven't predicted its extent all that well. Initially, resource prices fell more slowly than assumed, but lately they've been falling rather more quickly than either official or most private forecasts had assumed. So in some sense, this is not entirely unexpected, what's happening at the present time. Nonetheless, the actual event has been getting much attention. The various ramifications, like declining mining investment, the effects on incomes, the effects on government revenues, and so on, are the subject of daily news. So that's all happening, and in some respects is no great surprise. In some other respects, arguably not much has changed internationally lately. China continues to grow in size and importance and to open up. A lot was made recently of China missing, supposedly, its 2014 growth target by 0.1 percentage point. Well, we could hope actually that all our target misses in this country would be only that big. Much was also made of the lower target set in China for 2015, but actually that was always going to happen, and indeed successive growth objectives in the future are likely to get progressively lower as we go on. An economy as large as China is unlikely to sustain the sorts of growth rates seen in earlier years. Nobody keeps growing at 10% or more indefinitely, and they are no exception. But even growth that's a little bit lower than this year's reduced objective would still be a considerable impetus to global demand and output because China is so large now. That having been said, the outworking of some of the excesses of the earlier period of rapid growth in China, especially the period of rapid growth immediately after the global financial crisis, remains a work in progress. And we're talking here about the property cycle and all the associated debt that goes with that. Sorting that out is a work in progress and unavoidably remains a source of risk. In other ways, I think one could argue that the global backdrop for us has improved lately. And here I have in mind, as I've already said, that the US economy, still the world's largest and most innovative, has gained momentum over the past year, looking through all the temporary ups and downs that you inevitably get with statistics. For all of China's great importance to Australia these days, and there's no doubt of that importance, but still, a healthy US economy should not be underestimated as a driver of business thinking everywhere in the world, including here, and as a trendsetter for financial markets, even as we've seen in the past couple of days. In addition, the fall in oil prices, which is mostly the result of more oil being available at any given price than we had before, that's a bullish development for global growth, even if it's a problem for producer states of oil. It's certainly a bonus for American consumers, and it's a bonus for Australian consumers too. 32 billion litres of fuel sold in Australia a year, 25 cents a litre, that's $8 billion of extra income available to firms and households as a result of the decline in oil. That's 0.5% of GDP. Well, that's worth having. So this is actually a bullish point for the global economy and especially for America, and I would say also for Australia. Still on the US, it's expected that sometime this year the Federal Reserve will begin to lift the federal funds accelerator from its current position of flat to the floor, just lift it off just a little bit. If and when that happens, there will no doubt be some disruption, as there always is when the Fed makes a move. And the more so this time, probably because it's 9 years since the Fed last increased interest rates. And meanwhile, the European Central Bank and the Bank of Japan will be easing policy, so the major jurisdictions will be going in different directions. So there will be, for sure, I would say, some turbulence in asset and foreign exchange markets. But on the whole, I think we should regard the Fed's likely action as a positive. Fed policy is still likely to be very expansionary for quite some time yet. It isn't that the punch bowl is being taken away, it's just that the contents of the bowl are being made just a little less potent in the near term. Now, while all that's going on, as you know, our own economy continues its adjustment to the end of the investment phase of the mining boom. The massive run-up, and it truly was massive, in resource sector investment spending that was a natural response to very high commodity prices is now reversing, and that's causing a drag on aggregate demand. So we hope for other sources of demand in the economy to pick up some speed to make up the difference. And some of them are, though not quite as seamlessly as most of us would like. Now, I've talked a lot about this before, and so I won't labour the point today. The main point is this is a major transition. We can hope to give it some assistance, and the Reserve Bank is doing that, and we will continue to support this adjustment where we can, within the limits of our powers and consistent with our mandate. And the decline in the exchange rate is also assisting the transition, just as it assisted the handling of the earlier phase of the mining boom when the terms of trade were rising. So that's all helping. But we've always said, and I would repeat, we can't hope as policymakers to fine-tune a transition of this nature. We can help it, but if we think we can fine-tune it, we'd be kidding ourselves. When you look back at the history of these episodes, and there's been four or five of these prior to this one over the past 150 years, if we come through this one without either a major outbreak of inflation on the way up or a major crash in the economy on the way down, even if that means we have a period of sub-trend growth for a while, then we will have done much, much better than we ever did in any of these previous episodes. And I think that is still the most likely outcome. Even so, the lower terms of trade do mean that, all other things equal, the path of future incomes is not as high as it might have looked a few years ago. Even when we allow for the fact that we all knew intellectually that the very high terms of trade couldn't persist indefinitely. We all know that with our head, but it's a normal human tendency nonetheless to project what we see today, whether as good or bad, into the future. Eventually reality intrudes and we have to reevaluate, and that's what we've been doing as a society. That's happened countless times before, and it will again in the future, no doubt. But we are making that adjustment to a more realistic set of assumptions about future income, at least insofar as the terms of trade are concerned. That means that attention needs to be given to the sorts of things that help the economy work to deliver what we need, even with the lower terms of trade. These were the sorts of things that were actually making a difference before we had the mining boom. And you all know what they are. It's no secret. Things like open, competitive markets, education, skill building, flexibility and adaptability, quality public infrastructure, strong public institutions, pragmatic and balanced regulatory arrangements, and probably most importantly, rewards for entrepreneurial risk-taking. They're the things, not a mineral boom, they're the things that will give us the best chance for the kind of prosperity that we'd like to have. Public policy will naturally have its own contribution to make in fostering that sort of an environment. But it's businesses, large and small, it's all of you, And it's many businesses who probably are not big enough to be part of AmCham yet, but will be one day. It's all those people and the countless individuals out there in the economy making all their own choices that will ultimately deliver the kind of success that we're capable of. So that's the thought I wanted to leave you with, and now apparently we're going to have some questions. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you very much. We'll sit you over there, sir. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you.
Governor, can I start with the AAA credit rating that Australia has? In December, you warned, I think, that the AAA rating could be threatened if longer-term tax and spending issues weren't fixed. Are you more or less confident about our ability to maintain the AAA rating?
Well, Tiki, I don't think I talked specifically about the rating. Probably was interpreted as having done so. But the point I was trying to make was that we don't have a budgetary crisis at the moment. What we have at the moment, in fact, is remarkably benign conditions for government borrowing. Our government, and indeed the governments of most countries, are borrowing as cheaply as has ever been seen, ever. And the Commonwealth of Australia can borrow more cheaply today than any time since Federation.
But does a AAA rating matter?
Well, it does matter. But my point is, and this is, you know, people, Martin Parkinson has talked about this, Ken Henry talked about it before him, John Fraser's talking about it too. We're not on the correct path for the long run, and we need to get on to a better path, I think, during benign times, so that when not so benign times come, we're more resilient. I don't know when those times will come, but sooner or later they will. And my point is, we should be taking early, measured steps that will build up in their effect over the long term so that we sustain the position of strength we have. The AAA rating doesn't matter. Well, it matters. It's in a funding cost sense, the difference between AAA and AA plus is not large. But I think people with experience in this area would say that if you move down to one below, that's actually probably because you're on the path that doesn't stop there. And you don't want to be on that path. That's the point.
You said that if there was a downturn, potentially, you could go from 2% of GDP to 5 or 6% of GDP budget deficit in a heartbeat. Mm. Does the way we're going give sufficient policy flexibility to respond to other shocks?
Well, I think if, God forbid, a large negative shock came along right now, we still have macroeconomic scope to respond to that. We, with the budget, though, what you would find is a deficit that's 3% of GDP roughly now, it would be at 5 or 6 or 7 very quickly if we had a significant recession. And if you were then thinking, well, we'd like to do some discretionary stimulus on top of that, then you're talking about pretty big deficits. Mm. And I think you'd be in a better position to have the firepower for that discretion. Because bear in mind, when you go into a downturn, the deficit gets bigger anyway while the government does nothing because of the so-called automatic stabilizers. Mm. And that's appropriate. It's appropriate that the system has that design feature. But if you're then thinking we'd like to give some discretionary stimulus on top of that, the scope to do that's not looking as great as you might hope if the deficit's already gone to 5 or 6% of GDP. Mm. But I think capital markets would you know, ask a few more awkward questions of us than they have in recent years in that sort of an environment.
Let's move to rates. You talked a little bit about, you know, the thinking behind a possible lowering of rates, I think, just now. I'd like to ask you, what is the evidence that rates at the level that they are, which you've said are low, 2.25%, are holding the economy back?
A very fine question, and one that I've asked myself. I don't think, personally, that the current level of interest rates is really the main thing holding back the economy. I think anybody who's credit worthy can get credit very cheaply at present. Banks are willing to lend. They are a bit more discerning, or a fair bit more discerning on risk metrics than they were 6 or 7 years ago, but that's good. Even so...
So what's the benefit to a further 25
points? Let me finish. Even so, they're willing to lend. The fact that it isn't interest rates holding things back isn't the same thing as saying that there's no benefit from lowering them. There might be. That, of course, is something that we debate each month, and I'm not here to give a particular steer on forthcoming decisions, obviously. Mm-hmm. But, yeah.
You tailored your speech to America and Australia. Of course, we had...
Well, it is AmCham, after
it
all.
Is AmCham. We had Janet Yellen's comments about just because we've removed patient, it doesn't mean to say we're going to be impatient. The markets, I think, interpreted that as a September rate rise is more likely than a June one. What difference does a later rate lift in the US rather than an earlier one make to your deliberations?
I'm not sure that it makes a major difference. Time will tell. Financial market pricing, in fact, was already a little bit closer to September than June in my reading of it. So, in a sense, I think the Fed's language and positioning has moved a little bit towards where the market might already have been. It still seems the most likely outcome, I would say, based on what they've said, what market pricing is, how the US economy is travelling. The most likely outcome is the Fed funds rate will start to rise sometime this year, but I think it will be quite a gradual rise. I've always thought that was the most likely outcome, very gradual.
So you don't necessarily... Do you agree with Roger Corbett, RBA board member's comments the other day, where he said he was not sure, because it's always a little bit different when rates do start rising, quite what will happen and whether there might be
I think that's correct, because as I said in the prepared remarks, even though this is probably going to be the most telegraphed interest rate change in the history of the Fed, there still is a slight unknown quantity once the action comes. It's 9 years since they last did this, which means there's quite a few people in financial markets today who've never lived through a Fed rate rise cycle. So they've read about it, but they haven't lived through it. There will doubtless be some disruption, and there always is when the Fed starts to change.
Now, Governor, one of the other consequences, of course, of lowering rates is injecting risk into the economy, and not the sort that you might like, particularly boosting the share market and the property market. By lowering rates, aren't you encouraging a self-funded retiree or even a pensioner to take money out of savings and put it into one of the big banks right now?
Well, part of the way monetary policy works is... When you're easing, you lower the return on the zero risk or very low risk assets. That's part of the transmission mechanism. It always has been. The question is, and this is a question for central banks really right around the world, including for us, the question is how much of the real economy risk taking by the entrepreneurs that I was just talking about, how much of more of that you get at the end of this chain of causation. And that's harder to say, and one would have to say, I think, that at this point in time, The evidence for much more of that risk-taking globally is not that strong. The US would probably be the main exception. I think they've got a plausible story that says what the Fed has done has eventually led to more real economy risk-taking.
But are the issues of the housing market, particularly in Sydney, featuring more in your thinking now? Or
they've always featured in our thinking, because monetary policy works by this, partly through this channel. There are other channels as well, but one of the channels is you prompt changes in financial risk-taking behaviour. That's part of how it works. Mm. And it works through asset markets and credit conditions and credit growth. That's part of how it works. So we're always looking at what's happening to those parts of the system, because that's one of the things that we look at to see is it working or not.
You said before Christmas that you'd prefer to see an Aussie dollar closer to 75 US cents. We're almost there. But most currencies have dropped against the US dollar. Mm. And our commodity prices, iron ore, $55, have dropped. What level of Australian dollar would you be comfortable with now?
Well, we're not here to kind of nominate some new target today, I think.
But has it changed? Has that changed?
Well, I'd say the exchange rate's adjusting, possibly a little bit belatedly compared to what I might have at one stage thought likely. Mm. Nonetheless, when it was in the 90s, we were saying, look, we think people are underestimating the likelihood of a significant decline. I think we were right to say that.
But you mentioned the terms of trade issue.
There has been a significant decline. This is an adjustment that is probably not yet finished, would be my guess.
And that would be a good thing?
Well, it's part of the adjustment mechanism. It always has been, since we've been floating anyway.
I mean, there is a growing, I think, speculation out there, or belief out there, that really the lowering of these interest rates by the RBA is more about pulling the dollar down, and that we are now getting involved in currency wars.
I don't think the term currency wars was ever a very helpful description. I can remember being in the meeting where I think it was coined by the Minister of Finance from Brazil, and I can understand why he thought of things in those terms, but it's not very helpful to characterise countries that are supposed to be engaged in international cooperation as being at war with each other over currencies. The fact is currencies float, most of them. They adjust in response to differences in economic conditions, differences in rates of return across assets, changes in risk perception and what have you. And that's what it's doing. It's doing what it's supposed to do. And I think we should be content that the floating currency, which has served us well for more than 30 years, continues to do so.
Governor, I'd like to thank you very much for indulging me. I'd like to now open to the floor. Any questions out there? We have a couple of roving mics. Please, if you could state your name and where you are from. And can we forgive me, the lights are bad. But, over there. Thank you.
Sorry, Tim Lamb, Trumpet Capital. Glenn, in regard to rates, in 07, 08, you raised significantly. In 09, 10, you cut. Then you raised again through 11. Now you've cut, waited, and then cut again. I mean, are we going to see a reversal come November?
Well, I don't know. And if I did know, I'm not allowed to say, and if I tell you, I have to shoot you. I think they're the rules. Interest rates will be adjusted as needed to deliver as best we can the results that are our objectives. And right now, the prevailing question is, should they stay here or go down some more? It's been quite a while since we last increased them. I think that was 2010, actually, and they started to come down in 2011. So, you know, it depends on what happens is the answer.
There's one at the front.
Thank you.
Richard Glewis from The Australian. Governor, there's been some discussion recently about how the country might benefit from using good debt for infrastructure investment. It was mentioned most recently by Rob Whitfield from Westpac. I was just hoping to get your thoughts on using good debt to invest in productive infrastructure and how that might fit in with the political narrative that's going on at the moment.
Well, I'm not going to attempt to weigh into the political narrative. On the question of infrastructure and debt, I think in principle there's nothing wrong with debt against long-lived assets. And in fact, I suspect you'll find that private sector holders of long-lived assets will have some long-duration debt against that. That's perfectly fine. Really, though, on infrastructure in Australia, the problem isn't finding the money. You could argue about whether the government could find it or whether they could sell other assets to fund it. In a sense, either of those is a funding decision, really, and economically they're not that different. Or maybe the private sector could come up with the money. Funding it isn't the problem. The problem with doing infrastructure, the issues with doing infrastructure are governance, making sure you choose the right projects, and having a proper process of evaluation, optimal risk sharing, because there are some risks that the government is probably better placed to bear than the private sector at some points in the project, and then the private sector is better at bearing other sorts of risks. So risk sharing, and then pricing the use of the infrastructure once it's in place so that there's A, an appropriate price signal to the user, and B, the stream of revenue that makes this asset so attractive for a superannuation fund or whoever to hold. And to me, and this is something that came through very strongly in the infrastructure work stream that we had in the G20 last year, that was put onto the table by our treasurer. If you can sort out the governance, the risk sharing and the pricing, the funding isn't really the problem.
Governor, Ricky Polygenis, ANZ. When I worked for your organisation many years ago, we often used to think about monetary policy in a path of least regret type framework. So I'm wondering, and given that you've mentioned that the RBA is willing to support the economic transition that needs to occur, what would prevent you from cutting rates further? What are the risks associated with that?
Well, yes, it's a path of least regret framework, I think, still useful. And that framework tells you that growth's on the low side. It's not too bad, but it's not as good as we could do. Inflation's low. It's probably going to be okay. We're unlikely to have a problem with excessive inflation. And it's a world of very low rates. Interest rates should be low. They should be quite low. Well, they are. And really the debate at the margin is should they be a little bit lower or not. But let's not forget where the level is. But I'm not here to, you know, offer steering on the next decision or two. The board will meet and make up its mind, and you'll no doubt cover it in great detail, whatever we decide. But the framework is telling us to do roughly what we've been doing.
Good afternoon, Ulf Barnard from DB Schenker. I'm no economist, but putting aside monetary policy and interest rates, one fact that I feel needs more discussion in this country is productivity. And certainly you're talking about risk-taking entrepreneurs willing to invest money into businesses, employing people. I do feel there needs some major stimulus to facilitate that next wave of risk-taking and employment growth again. but the basis of that will certainly be an improved productivity platform, both in the products and the services sector. What is your view on that?
Well, I couldn't agree more. But the instrument that I'm responsible for setting has basically no effect on productivity in any direct fashion. I've talked a lot about productivity myself, and it's noticeable, actually, that in many audiences I'm asked, what do we do about productivity? And the answer I've been giving for several years is there's a body called the Productivity Commission. They've published forests worth of papers on this. There's a list of things there. Let's get the list. And at that point, there's a lot of nervous shuffling of feet and looking at the floor, because the things on that list for the political process are very demanding. They're very hard to do. They're politically costly, and they naturally tend to shy away from them. Nonetheless, the Productivity Commission is the experts. They've got, I don't know how many PhDs working on this, and they're the guys to ask about how to get productivity. And it's opening markets, which we really haven't fully completed, enabling, flexibility, capabilities, all those things. And Gary Banks gave a superb speech when he finished as chair of the PC. It's all there.
Yes, sir.
Hi, Mr. Stevens, John Jury from The Australian. If I could take you back to your interest rate decision last month where you cut rates, you had put on record the prior year that you weren't going to cut rates without changing the words in your monetary statement, and yet you disregarded that. And you also, and prior to that, there was some publication of some very timely figures which sort of pointed to your direction, both of which upset the markets a bit, and they thought they were taken by surprise and thought that maybe you'd shot yourself in the foot a bit with the way you made the change. Could you comment on that, please?
Well, firstly, nobody has the right never to be surprised in financial markets. There are going to be surprises from time to time. And that's never going to change. Secondly, on the language, it was obvious to me very soon after we started talking using the period of stability language that eventually that would be a problem. Bear in mind that the whole point of that language when we first started to use it about 2 years ago was the moment we signal, look, we've been cutting rates, but we're going to sit now. In this country, the tendency is for the media and the markets to immediately rush to the other side of the boat and say, well, now if they're not cutting, they will be increasing. And we weren't even thinking of increasing, and we wanted to try to resist the tendency for the market to price rate rises in 2014. It didn't stop plenty of people speculating about them anyway, because it doesn't matter how clearly you say it, there are still some people who want to run with that speculation. But that was the purpose of the stability language, and I always knew that sooner or later that language itself and any possible change in it is going to be a potential problem. That's just the way it is with any kind of language. As you can see, with the intense debate over the past few months over one single word in America, the word patient. And would it be there, and when will it be taken out, and what will that mean? So the use of any particular language is fraught with danger and difficulty. That is just in the nature of things. And there was always going to come a moment when we were either going to change the language, and that would have been a huge kerfuffle in markets, or actually change the rate. Either way, some people were going to be surprised by either of those events. And so it proved to be. But, if it's the right thing to do, to adjust the rates, then it's the right thing to do, even if it's a bit of a surprise. On the issue of how big a surprise is it, well, I would simply note that as early as Christmas, there were some people, not the majority, but there were some, openly speculating that rates would start to come down again in the early part of this year. There were a few more of them by February. And, you know, I just don't think you could claim, and you're not claiming, but no one could claim, that somehow this came from nowhere completely out of the blue. There was always some possibility of it happening by the time we got to the February meeting. And then it was a matter, from our point of view, of timing, and I think the minutes of the February meeting made that pretty clear. So that's what I have to say about those matters.
Governor, it's Ben Potter from the Australian Financial Review. Is now the time for a dull budget, and what, in your view, would be the consequences of Australian Commonwealth debt going to 60% of GDP in the coming years, as has been discussed in Canberra in the last few days? Thank you.
Well, actually, the figure of 60% of GDP that was quoted and which featured on the front page of your august journal yesterday, that is a projection of debt to GDP in the year 2054-55, 40 years from now. It was not a figure that anybody was proposing is going to be seen anytime soon. I think that bit of context is worth stressing. Whether the budget, I don't really give gratuitous public advice about fiscal policy. What I've said about the budget accounts for the long run are the things I said to Tiki earlier today, and I've said on other occasions. We are on a path which is not terribly damaging to us in any near-term horizon, but it's not a path we really should be on over the medium term. It would be wise for us to do what we can in a measured and early way to get onto a better track. And I think fiscal policy this year, next year, the year after, and so on, should be framed with that in mind.
Governor Stevens, Peter Ryan from the ABC. I think the afternoon after the February rate cut, you briefed Federal Cabinet, or you had a briefing with Federal Cabinet, and I was wondering if you might be able to let us know what your impressions of Federal Cabinet were, and whether or not these type of briefings are going to be commonplace while you're still Governor. Thank you.
Well, it would be completely inappropriate for me to convey anything about the details of a meeting in the Cabinet room, because what happens in the Cabinet room is supposed to stay in the Cabinet room, and certainly whatever is said about it won't come from me. I was asked to go and brief them on the economy. I did that. How regular or otherwise, I mean, they haven't been a frequent occurrence in my time. Whether or not it happens again, and if so, on what frequency, would be entirely a matter for the Prime Minister.
Time for one last question or two? One over there.
Thank you, Governor Stevens. John Richardson. Australia hosted the G20 summit process last year. And I very much welcome your comments on the progress that you see has been made to the reform of the international financial system, the reform of the IMF, the World Bank, and also moves to harmonise or to avoid tax minimisation across the major jurisdictions. Thank you.
I couldn't hear that question very well, but I think it was about G20 and international financial reform. That's what I'm going to answer anyway. The Financial Stability Board, which is the coordinating body charged with trying to help the various standard setters move to the new the revised regulatory arrangements in a more or less coordinated way, is working very hard. The key themes that were to be delivered last year in our G20 year were, we're making progress on derivatives reform. There's a proposal for total loss absorbing capacity for the globally systemic banks on the table, Basel III implementations proceeding, and so on. This set of work streams is extremely demanding, and the global regulatory community is working extremely hard on it. There's a long way to go. It's important, I think, that we keep our eyes on the main prize and not bring in too many additional regulatory items onto the agenda simply because we are running flat out to deliver what we've committed. But I would remain confident that we'll end up in the right place in a few years' time.